the question, I'll repeat again, when you became president and when you left, the changes that were made as far as medical plans and pensions, did you ever dream that you would be able to get that much
coverage? No, we never dreamed it for many reasons. First of all, the companies had the money. The people with money had the control. So we never expected to be able to extract as much from the companies. That, now this is in 46. But not only that, but until 1950, it was against the law to negotiate pensions. We got a Supreme Court decision in 1950 that gave the unions the right to negotiate pensions. So everything that we've done on pensions and insurance, stuff like that, was done after the Supreme Court decision of 1950. So no, we never expected to do anything nearly as well as what we did. We thought we'd do better. At least we established ourselves some dignity. Before then, you weren't allowed to talk back. If the boss man told you something, you say yes, sir, and no, sir. So we never expected that, no.
Okay. And, let's see. Later on, did you do much traveling at the beginning of when you were president of the local, or that's...
We did a lot of traveling because we got our first contract here on a local basis just with the Gadsden plant. That was in 1943 when we got our first one. The next one we didn't get till 46 or 47, but we got it on the company-wide basis. We had Akron plant, New Bedford plant, Topeka, Kansas plant, California plant, and several Goodyear plants that got together around over the country. We'd meet together in central locations to negotiate, and sometimes we'd be gone for weeks and weeks at a time. Not only that, I served 11 years on the International Union Executive Board. That's the group of people who controls the union between conventions. And we'd have usually quarterly meetings, and we'd meet in various parts of the United States and Canada in those board meetings. So I did travel a lot.
And these meetings, when it first, toward the beginning of the union era, when you'd go talk to these other plants, when you were on this board, you talked to other members that were union representatives from other plants, when they talked to you about the emotions of the company people and union people, were they similar to yours, or was it the attitude different up north or out west?
A lot of them were similar, but a lot of them were different because a lot of the company, what they call company policy, wasn't company policy. It depended on what some individual thought. So you might take one plant manager, say, in Los Angeles, California, that was sympathetic towards his workers, wanting to treat workers right, and he'd have him a set of rules. But the same guy down here in Gadsden, Alabama, might hate unions with a vengeance and hate everybody that's in a union. So you did not have uniform policies in the beginning. Now, after we signed our first contract in about 1947, I believe it was, then we began to get uniform treatment over the country, but it still isn't uniform. It's still, you can't take it out of individuals' hands because there is a difference in individual. But company policy generally is the same nationwide now, and it used not to be.
Yeah, but it was. So what you're saying, it was a little bit once y'all started having the meetings or getting organized on a national basis, you got more legislation or whatever.
We began to bring ourselves together, and of course what we tried to do was take the best that we could find in any one plant and put in all of them. And the company tried to take the worst in any plant and put in all of them. So we had some pretty good battles. But generally speaking, we were able to bring most of our benefits the uniformity. Where if you've got 6 weeks vacation in Akron, Ohio, you got 6 weeks vacation in Gadsden, Alabama. And it wasn't that way before.
Okay.
Granny gives me them feels. Another thing about establishing a union in a community like Gadsden, Alabama, the company had done such a salesmanship job on all of the community till all the public officials everywhere was against the union. They were for the company. You take the mayor, chief police, the sheriff, the deputies, the policemen, all the public officials, and most of the preachers was against unions. So we had to prove ourselves. We had to prove ourselves to be a part of the community. And we did that. An example right now, today, as we speak, a former president of Local 12's son is a sheriff of Eddywell County. And he wasn't the first member of Local 12. We had another member of Local 12 named Dewey Calvert to become sheriff of Eddywell County. And we had a situation where nobody had anything to do with the union back in them days, and a man wouldn't begin to run for mayor today or sheriff or something like that without going and consulting with the union people. And they learned that most of their money and their church places coming out of the working man's pocket. It wasn't coming out of them big shots' pockets. So the labor unions are generally accepted as the backbone of the community now.
Yes. That's when you were talking about they tried to make the company feel that that they were doing a good to the community. When they come in, they were offering jobs and a place to work.
Yeah. They figure that they're doing you a favor by letting you work and make them money.
Did they have like when they first opened this plant? I know it's different from we've seen documentaries and stuff on coal miners. Did they have a company village or a store?
There was on the village now. There was a real estate company here, known as Lay Brothers Realty Company, and they built what we call the Goodyear Village. That's all these houses here in East Gadsden is built for Goodyear people to live in. But what happened, they invested that money and built them houses. The Depression come along, they didn't have anybody to live in the houses. So everybody that went to work for Goodyear, if you lived in Kalamazoo, Michigan, you paid rent on one of these houses. They charged you house rent whether you lived in it or not. And sometimes them boys off Sand Mountain, including myself, we live up there, drive down here to work, and you go by to see your house you're paying rent on, it might be two or three people paying rent on that same house. Now, on the store part of it, Goodyear never had what they called them commissaries back in those days. But the steel plant did. They had the steel plant commissary. And there's other companies here, Mill out here. They had an old company store and all that. But Goodyear never had these company stores per se like the miners did. The miners owned the houses, they owned the stores, they owned the churches, they owned it all. But Goodyear didn't have that. But they did have this building thing that they made you pay rent on whether you lived in it or not.
And I'm about finished here. You're in the union when you were president. You had to learn. You go back when you were 14. You said you understand what was going on during the Depression. You were old enough to know that you had to work, you know, to support you and your family. So when you went into the union, when you become president, I guess you had to, if you you didn't know about politics, you had to learn when you got in there, didn't you?
Well, yeah, well, not only politics that you had to know, but when you sit down across the table to negotiate with the company, they had PhDs and AR pars and everything else behind their name. They'd been to college, they were well trained, and I was sitting over there and never finished the seventh grade. So if I told a man he didn't know what he's talking about, I didn't only have to tell it, I had to prove it. So I had a lot of research work to do. I had to drag out lots of history and a lot of current events and study them, and even a lot of economics that I knew nothing about. I had to learn it before I could sit down and tell the company they were wrong, which I had to do plenty of times.
Yes.
The company wasn't always right just because they
were the company.
The best because they were educated.
Okay. And so you would have to meet with them many times, you know.
To work out differences.
Work out differences. And arbitration. How did this... what exactly, I mean, you know, there's some people that are my age that hear the word and all they know is it's something between a company and a union. What exactly goes on during arbitration?
All right, to set it up just like a court case over at the courthouse. But the two parties, the company and the union, jointly agree to one man that's the arbitrator. And he's the sole court. He's the judge, the jury, and the whole thing. And what he says goes. Now, they meet. Union presents its side to the arbitrator. The company presents its side. And they argue back and forth. And they show what's happened, say, in Texas. Here's what happened in this case in Texas. Here's what this case... That's what happened in this case up in Washington, D.C. And they cite all these different arbitration cases from all over the country in support of their position. The arbitrator goes home, sits down, writes the decision, and sends it back, and you better do what he said. Because he's it.
Most of the time, the company and the union would have to agree on the arbitrator.
We'd have to agree on the arbitrator.
Most of the time, was it a judge or a...
Most of the time it was a, really, because of the time that we were getting in it, it was people who had experience with the federal government. The War Labor Board, National Labor Relations Board, or some government agency that they had worked for that gave them some knowledge in that field. They may have worked for the Department of Labor. Now, there is a different type of arbitration to what I just described. I described the kind we used. There is another type they call a tripartite, and that's three arbitrators. The union arbitrator, company arbitrator, and then an arbitrator that those two agree on.
Somebody neutral.
Yes. He's supposed to be the arbitrator. But it's actually a tripartite. There's three of them. And so the union writes up a decision, the company writes up a decision, and then the head man writes up a decision. So sometimes, occasionally, you have a union man and an arbitrator take the same position. It might be a company man and an arbitrator take the same position. Or it might be that man just bounces up and takes a position of his own. So that's what they call a tripartite system. And I have served on those boards too, where there was three arbitrators.
Okay, and
let me, one I believe might have, couldn't you, when you had a list of arbitrators, couldn't you strike a union, could strike one, just like striking a jury?
Yeah.
So we don't want this and this time?
Yeah. Yeah, we could strike. We could take, say, if you had 11 people on a list, you'd take time about striking them off, which ones you didn't want, and you had what was left.
And what was left? Okay. And one thing, the way I was hitting this up on about learning politics, I'm too young, I barely remember it, but you were talking about the community finally accepting the union as the good people. And you talked about Mr. Colbert being the
sheriff,
and now James Hayes is sheriff, and his father worked with you for all these 20-odd years in the union. And you yourself run for mayor in what year was it?
1970. It was in the runoff, but was not elected.
Was not elected. But you did see, I mean, you know, the support to get in a runoff, it had to be close to get in a runoff. So you pretty well had a lot of support from
there. There was five of us in the race, and I run second.
Okay. Well, that about all the questions here, especially the union questions, Mike. I think it's going to be real helpful to our class. I appreciate it.
You're a good man. Tell them to give us a great A.
We need an A.